there's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us.
Thank you, Rob Hart. John Williams here on a Saturday afternoon until 3 o'clock. And yeah, let's start with a little David Bowie for obvious reasons. David Bowie passed away this week. And this song by Bowie was in The Martian, and we talk movies in this first segment. Our Mincing Rascals in the next half hour, we'll talk a little bit about the President's State of the Union address and the Republican debate. I saw both of them, and neither of them were especially uplifting. Plus, I'm just kind of down this week anyway, Rob, because I didn't win the Powerball, and I was in a couple of pools. I know that my chances weren't good to win, but since this one has had us anticipating since last November, I had more of a ramp up to it. I was living longer with this pool of money I didn't have than any other pool of money I've never had. You know what I mean? So not winning it that day was more upsetting than I thought it would be.
Well, if you do buy the ticket, there's a little sliver of your psyche or your consciousness that buys into the idea, well, now there's a non-zero chance of me becoming a billionaire. I mean, I know we in the media like to shame you into thinking you're a fool for buying a lottery ticket because the odds are so astronomical. But once you buy that ticket, there's literally is a non-zero chance of you winning, and that chance in your mind just gets larger and larger as the drawing grows near. So I understand why you'd feel crestfallen.
Thank you for that. That's all I asked. You know, the market gave up like a trillion points this week, and yet I was more despondent, not about my 401k, but about the fact that I didn't get the $1.5 billion. Two quick statistics for you that you can share with your friends. These are the ones that stood out to me this week. Your chances of winning are the equivalent of taking a coin and flipping it and having it come up the same. How many times in a row would you guess? You would guess hundreds of times, perhaps. 24. If you get a coin out now and can flip it 24 times and it comes up the same, that would be the equivalent of winning the lottery. If you do that, they're not going to send you a check, but I just thought that was kind of a fun fact. And a colleague of mine also pointed out that you are five times as likely to have two penises as you are to win the lottery. So I'll let you. And that doesn't play for everybody I know, but
the question is, do you take that in a lump sum or do you go for the annuity?
We're talking 10 penises here, by the way, so I don't know how that all translates.
Installment plan.
The nominees came out this week, of course, for the Academy Awards. The Best Picture nominees, I've seen all but one of them, and we'll join our guests now to talk a little bit about the films that you really liked. And here's what I want you to do in this segment. Call in and tell me the movie or the film that you advocate for, that you tell your friends, oh, you got to go see this. This is so good. The nominee, and they don't have to be the picture or the performance or the star that you advocate for, but they don't have to be in the Best Picture category. But to be clear, they were Spotlight, Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Brooklyn, Mad Max, Martian, Revenant, and Room. The best picture I saw this year was Spotlight. The most fun was Mad Max Fury Road. In fact, I love our guest's review of this. In fact, let's put her on right now. Amy Nicholson joins us from LA Weekly, soon to be, I understand, the chief film critic for MTV. Amy, it's John Williams. Welcome to the show. How are you?
John Williams, I'm great. Hello.
I'm going to read your review of Mad Max Fury Road. Are you ready?
Okay.
It goes like this. Buckle up. Vroom. And that's all you need to say. That's the that's the best review of a movie I've ever read.
Well, you see a ton of movies. I see a ton of movies. I love it when I see something for work and I immediately buy a ticket to go see it opening weekend again and bring seven friends. That's
yeah.
The sort of movie Mad Max was. And it's, you know, not the kind of movie people used to expect would get an Oscar nom. So it's really exciting that it did.
Yeah, I feel the same way, and I'm not the movie expert. Trust me, I'm way on the sidelines on this. I've seen these movies, but I would say that's the one movie I would want to go back right now and watch again. If it was on TV, I would definitely click on, although it's better on the big screen. But what a fun movie Fury Road was.
It was, and it was just so well crafted. That movie has earned, you know, 10 nominations total. A lot of them are for technicals, and it just earns it. You know, it's rare that you see an action movie that tries to deliver not just spectacle, but really well-done spectacle, not just explosions, but, like, perfect choreography, and then to have a really good story at the heart of it, and to cast actors like Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy. You know, it's just really well done all around.
Every little thing about it. And the stuff that doesn't make sense or you don't have to worry about, they don't even worry about. It's like, let's put a guitar player on the front of an SUV. That could be fun. And that'll be that. I don't know that there's any point in trying to drill down too deep on the logic or the point or the sense of the whole thing, right?
It's true, although I have to admit, one of my favorite things about Mad Max Fury Road is just imagining all the pre-production meetings at Warner Brothers. With George Miller being like, no, 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 guys, really, a flaming guitar. And they're like, all right, man.
Okay, and then the motorcycle will drive under the truck. Why and how are we going to do that? And what? Okay, fine, let's do that. So in the spirit of your review of Mad Max Fury Road, buckle up, vroom. I sort of have a short list of or description of the movies that are in that Best Picture category, and here's mine. For the movie Spotlight, that was the best picture I saw this year. For The Big Short, not as clever or funny as you heard or as it thinks. For Brooklyn, I just thought this was a terrific, straight-on love story, the likes of which you just don't see that often anymore. Mad Max Fury Road, I'm completely with you. The Martian, Matt Damon, cracking wise in space. I fully expected him to hold up to the camera back to Earth. You like apples? How do you like these apples? It's just a fun, fun, smart movie and reintroduced me to the concept of competence porn this year. The Revenant is beautiful. I'll say that about it. And The Room was surprisingly watchable. What strikes you on that list of mine?
You know, you just used the word competence porn. And honestly, that could sum up about 60% of the films on this list. This is a big year for films about men who know how to do things really well. You know, even Bridge of Spies, a guy who's a really good negotiator, Big Shorts, guys who are really good at figuring out the stock market. It's a very almost macho year, even though the type of macho it's taking is everything from Leonardo DiCaprio eating a bison liver, you know, to guys just being amazing investigative journalists. What pops out on that list is really Brooklyn and Room, two movies I just loved a lot and have such a strong female sensibility.
I agree with you on that.
Like the marvel of the year. Yeah.
I think, and that was the surprise of the year, too. I mean, I dragged myself into that one because I thought, oh, Lord, this is a hard subject, and I don't want to watch these people in a room for 2 hours. First of all, you don't. Half of the movie, they're liberated, and it's surprising. It's really well made, and I don't know that it's uplifting, but it's not a downer either, is it?
No, I feel like Room, what sticks out to me about it is its optimism. Everyone's worried, you know, about the fate of this little kid who's grown his whole life up in this, you know, shack in the back of a backyard. And what Lenny Abramson digs out of this really tremendous actor, Jacob Tremblay, is that he's okay. You know, if any person grows up in terrible circumstances, if they don't know their terrible circumstances, maybe they can find happiness. And to me, that's, you know, what's so striking about Brie Larson's performance and why I'm so glad that she gets the nom. And, you know, if we're going to be honest, I hope she wins Best Actress, because her character has to do so many things at once in that film. You know, she has to capture the idea of being a teen girl who was locked in this room, but also be a mother who's trying to stay positive for her son. And there's this little moment where you see her trying to channel all this love and enthusiasm about this horrible cell that they're trapped in. And as soon as he glances away, you get to see her face fall just a little bit. And there's all these things her character can't say, but she has to get them to us without him ever finding out.
Were there times in the movie where you were mad at her for not working harder to get out?
You know, this is my own personal bias. Every time I see a movie like this or a horror film or anything where people are running in the woods, I think, I can't run and I wouldn't survive anything. So I can't, who am I to judge? I might crumple in any of these films.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe my perspective is, you know, athletic male, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to jump him, or I'm going to put a stick in the door. The next time he comes in, it won't close. I'll hit him with a frying pan. I mean, they did have access to some things, and while she did talk in the movie about one failed attempt to escape, I thought that would have had to have been a bigger part of her life. At least, maybe they didn't show it, but that was sort of nagging me a little bit in the movie, but not much, not enough to take away my enjoyment of it, that's for sure.
Well, John, now I'm thinking you should have starred in The Revenant.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, right. If you to know me. I mean, trust me, Amy, I've overstated my case by a mile. Amy Nicholson is on the line, and she's the film critic for LA Weekly, and you'll be seeing her reviews at MTV as well. I want you to call 312-981-7200. Tell me the movie, the scene, the actor, the actress, the performance that you are advocating for this year. We all do it. We see a movie, and then we go tell our friends. So I'll pick up some phone lines on that in a minute. And while we've gone through the list of the Best Picture nominees, and I've talked about some of the ones I liked, as have you, I haven't touched on your list of your top 10, and I'll start with your number one. It's Chi-Raq. Why?
Well, you know, Chi-Raq, for people who haven't seen it, which might be a lot of people, it didn't get the biggest push from Amazon. It's one of the first high-class Amazon films that they've released, and they just did it right under the wire in December. It's a musical written and directed by Spike Lee, but based on the ancient Greek text Lysistrata, which is about a group of women who decide to form a sex strike in order to get the men in their city, here in modern-day Chicago,
right,
to stop warmongering. And it's just this bold, brave picture. You know, Spike has been, you know, on iffy Turk territory for the last 15 years. But this feels almost like a return to form, like the young, angry, passionate, and super funny Spike Lee, who may do the right thing. So to me, it's like we talk a lot, we've been talking a lot in the last few days since the Oscar nominations came out about how this list is so white and people are name-checking, you know, films that a lot of people like better than I did, like Creed and Straight Out of Compton. Chi-Raq, to me, is the film that's most glaringly most glaringly absent from this list. It's so bold, it's so vital, it's the story of where we are today. And also, this is the year when Spike Lee is actually getting an honorary Oscar from the Board of Governors at the Academy. He accepted it in November. It's nice that they gave him an award offstage, but it feels like this should be a year where that film needs to be right in the middle of the mix, and it hasn't gotten a single nomination.
Amy Nicholson's on the line. We'll pause here, and she and I will entertain your calls next on WGN. Let's go back to our guest. Amy Nicholson's on a phone line. She's at LA Weekly, and will we be watching you on MTV or reading you on their website, Amy?
You'll be doing both. I'll be doing a ton of writing, as much as I've been doing at the Weekly, long-form interviews, everything. And I think they're also going to have me do everything from a little bit of TV news to a little bit of, I don't know, Snapchatting. The world's changed a lot since I watched MTV when I was young.
You would review something via Snapchat? But then, okay, I won't even.
Oh, no. I think they'll just have me Snapchatting from places like Cannes, being like, hello, I'm in France.
Oh, okay, good. Because I would think I would like a little more time with your review.
Well, if I just get to say buckle up room, I think we're fine.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's pick up a couple of phone lines. We'll start with Carolyn. Thanks for holding, Carolyn. You're on WGN. What film are you pushing for?
Revenant. It was amazing. I've seen most of the movies that were nominated. And I saw Room, and I was like, wow, that was really good. And then I saw Spotlight, and I was like, oh, my God, that's like the best movie of the year.
Yeah.
And my husband was like, you know, I want to go see Revenant. And I'm like, okay, I'll go along. And I read some articles about, you know, what went into the making of it, and it kind of piqued my interest a little bit more. We went, we saw the movie. Both of us walked out of there. It's one of the best movies either of us have ever seen in our lives. It was unbelievable. It was amazing. It was people just talk about this bear attack, and that just kind of like washes away everything else that goes on in the movie, which is so frustrating. Not only is the scenery just spectacular, but, you know, the acting is great. Sure, there's some battle scenes in it that are, you know, a little bit gory, but the survival of just the personal self, and it was amazing. I'm pushing for that 100%.
What a great call. Carolyn, thanks for the call. Kevin, what's the movie that you're pushing for? You're on WGN.
I'm pushing for The Big Short. I'm a big fan of Michael Lewis's, read the book, and when I heard that they were making this into a movie, I was like, how are they going to explain some of these really complex, you know, things that were going on in the financial markets? And the way that they did it by having celebrity cameos, you know, Ryan Gosling is talking to the screen and he says, well, why don't we have, you know, Penelope Cruz explain this? And then you cut to Penelope Cruz at a craps table and she explains this very complex financial, you know, terminology that they're using. And it's just, it's very funny, sadly funny, just because of the fact that, it's true. And it just, you know, Steve Carell was phenomenal in it.
I thought he was. It's funny he didn't get nominated, but I'm with you. I think his performance was the best. I'm running short of time, Kevin. Great call. Thank you for joining us. And finally, let's just get one more in here. Mike, what's the movie you're advocating for? You're pushing for who or what?
Brooklyn, Saoirse Ronan, unbelievable portrayal of this Irish immigrant girl who falls in love with this Italian-American in Brooklyn, and the portrayal of the world before it was wired the way it is today is also transformative. I mean, it's just so much food for thought in that movie.
I couldn't agree with you more. And where she's turning her hope over to the Catholic Church in light of some of the other movies that are nominated or what's happening in the world, you think, oh, God, please don't get dark. And it doesn't. The movie's delightful, isn't it?
She's luminous. She's just so deeply affecting, an amazing performance.
Well, great calls. How about that? I presume you agree with everything you just heard, right, Amy?
Every single word of it. I mean, I like the range of opinions in this, and that they're all so strong and passionate. It just makes me happy to hear people be passionate about films, you know, especially films about the stock market and immigration.
Let's watch you on TV, follow you on Snapchat, and continue to read you at LA Weekly. I hope you'll come on with us again, Amy.
I would love to. This is a lot of fun.
Amy Nicholson, thank you now. WGN Radio News coming up next. Rob, I'm going to play here part of the conversation I had with Steve Bertrand, Eric Zorn, and Krista McQuarrie. Normally, she wasn't able to join us on this podcast, our Mincing Rascals post. It dropped on Friday. And we're going to talk in this post a little bit about the State of the Union address and debates generally. Did you happen to notice poor Paul Ryan's expression on his face during the State of the Union address?
I did. And that's always a no-win situation because you don't emote and you look petulant, or you emote too much, and that was John Boehner's problem. He made all sorts of weird faces during the speech.
He did. He was fun to read, now that you mention it, wasn't he? Yeah. Well, that's part of the conversation that we'll dive into here. So we have Eric Zorn, the columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and he records with us every Friday, and we post the podcast on Fridays. It's there right now. You can catch it at WGNplus.com on my Facebook page. I'm King John there. You can also just subscribe to Mincing Rascals at iTunes. We start here with Steve Bertrand talking about the debate. We'll segue to the State of the Union address. This is Bertrand on the debate and Carly Fiorina.
How about Carly Fiorina saying that she loves her husband more than Hillary does?
It was her opening line. And every debate, I've championed Fiorina. I like her at the big table. I think she's smart. I think she's eloquent. She's studied. And when she said that, I wrote her off. I thought, God almighty, whichever of these Republicans becomes the nominee, even Carly Fiorina, they're going to bring up Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton. And I think that's...
Okay, so let me ask you guys this. I have respect for both of you. And Morning Joe is a show that I watch and listen to on MSNBC. I think it's a great show. Carly Fiorina was on Friday, was asked about it again, and she said, look, I would have left my husband had he done those things. And then right after she was done, they replayed what Fiorina said, what she said, basically, I love spending time with my husband more than Hillary did with hers or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unlike the other woman in the race.
Right.
I enjoy spending time with my husband.
There you go. So, you know, Fiorina defended that and went further saying, I would have left my husband. And then 10 minutes later, Hillary Clinton was on Morning Joe on the phone. And I'm texting back and forth with a buddy of mine saying, are they going to ask her? Are they not going to ask her? And they didn't ask her to respond to Fiorina's comment or accusation. And I just wonder, would either of the two of you asked her? I mean, their point when they were talking to Fiorina was, this doesn't belong in the campaign. You know, we should all be above this. So I get why they might not ask her. But if you're presenting it to your audience and you've got A and then B's coming up next, wouldn't you have asked B about it?
Two wrongs don't make a right is my attitude about that one, Steve. I don't know. What do you think, Eric?
Well, once the first answer was given, once that accusation was lobbed out there, I do think they ought to give her a chance. They ought to say, do you want to respond to this? And, right. I think she would
Maybe.
Have said no.
She's probably relieved it. I'm sure she's relieved it wasn't asked.
What information would we have gleaned from that? I mean, how is Bill Clinton an issue in the Hillary Clinton campaign?
There's an op-ed in the Tribune today that argues that his behavior, accompanied by her enabling of it, her forgiveness of it, her turning a blind eye to some of these accusations is an issue. And now, I don't agree with that.
Connect the dots for me on that. Isn't that blaming the victim? And beyond that, how does Bill's infidelity tell me anything about Hillary's ability to be president?
Well, it is painful to go back to this and relitigate the Monica Lewinsky business of whatever it was 18 years ago now, because it was sickening then, and it's sickening and irrelevant now. But the idea is that he committed a workplace violation when he had sexual relations with that woman. And that Ms. Lewinsky, and that he may have had some other predatory, Juanita Broderick, Paula Jones, that he may have had some predatory behavior that was illegal or sexual assault, and that she defended him against that and didn't adequately look into that. Now, I don't think that, ask other spouses in America whether they would have thrown their husband's career out over something like that.
Well, it's going to be hard for her to go out on the campaign trail and talk about women's rights and respect for women in the workplace and all of that while this is also part of her history.
It is. I don't think it's going to be a thing that's going to decide a whole lot of votes, frankly, especially given how polarized this campaign looks.
Gee, maybe the Republicans or the Congress should have had an investigation into it and looked into this, and then we wouldn't be relying on Hillary Clinton to be the decider for everybody.
I think Ken Starr is going to look into Cruz's eligibility for president. So,
but boy, Christie said last night, I'm not going to let Hillary Clinton within 10 miles of the White House.
Well, it's like, and Barack Obama is a terrorism enabler, an apologist, and
they kick his butt out of the White House or something.
I thought,
we're talking about disrespect and everything. You had asked if there was anything, something just came to mind about, what did you guys think of Kim Davis at the State of the Union address?
Yeah, my son was furious. That's the first text I got from him was, oh my God, Kim Davis is there.
Kim Davis is the Kentucky County Clerk who refused to issue gay marriage licenses and went to jail for defying a federal judge.
Yeah.
So she went to jail for defying federal law, and someone, did we ever learn who, used his or her ticket to invite her to the State of the Union address.
I really dislike this entire State of the Union ritual. Everything about it is just...
Congressman invited Muslims.
I hate the guest rituals. I hate the half the room stands up and applauds and the other half sits on its hands. I hate all that stuff. Just if he wants to give a speech about the State of the Union, he should do it from the Oval Office, and then they could have the Republican response, and that can be it. But this...
would miss the drama and the theater
miss that.
Of it.
I'm tired of it.
I'm assuming, though, the Muslims didn't violate federal law and weren't, they weren't invited to.
Right. Correct.
They weren't invited to a night that celebrates the rule of law in the federal government.
You know who bothered me the most at the State of the Union was Paul Ryan.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Why?
Oh, Lord. Because when Barack Obama said, let's make curing cancer our next moonshot, even then he wouldn't stand and applaud. He was so poker faced. There was a story about this in the USA Today, and I'm glad at least at the end of the interview they brought it up. And he said, yeah, I tried to stay as stoic and neutral as I could the whole time.
But you can't be neutral. He's bringing up, he's giving these lines about one thing, we welcomed home our veterans and wounded
warriors.
Yeah, that's
Sweden's job. You are the House, Speaker of the House.
He doesn't applaud for our wounded veterans. I get that it's all partisan, and he's got, but that's not a place, it's ridiculous to have him sitting there, everyone watching him over the president's shoulder. What's he doing? That's ridiculous. The whole thing is ridiculous.
What do you think of the what do you think of the other party's address after the speech?
First of all, Nikki Haley, it was like her jaw was wired shut.
That's the most stupid thing.
It is, but they ought to because it's such a, it ends up being such a partisan speech, they need to give equal time. I thought it was
strange. But it wasn't that partisan.
She spent all her time bashing Trump. A lot of her time. And I thought that was very interesting. I think that shows that the party is quite afraid of what's going to happen if he's nominated. But I don't think it's a whole lot better for them if Cruz is nominated.
I hate that address.
I think you're right about that.
From whomever gives it, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, it's always stupid. It never sounds good. They never look good. Marco Rubio, remember reaching for the bottle of water?
Bobby Jindal.
It's the same for the Democrats. Frankly, I don't watch it. And it is different. If you are the president of the United States, you get to stand there and make your case. That's what the night is. The night isn't about, well, let's hear the other view now. That's what the TV shows afterward are for.
I'm all for
flooding the, you know, and I watch all the news shows after it. That's where you put your subject, your surrogates to make the case for the sitting other party. That the idea of the stifling a post address.
Here I am critical of Paul Ryan because he could not stand with the president on curing cancer because he thought that wouldn't play to the base. And yet there was the Republican Party's rebuttal to the State of the Union. And in fact, it was everything Ryan wouldn't do. It conceded that we own part of the problem. We're half of the House. And it's a Republican problem as well as a Democrat one. And she gave them all of the bones they needed, right? She said that health care is a failure and we don't stand up to terrorism enough. She said all those things that you're supposed to say to the Republicans. But then she said we need to put down the angry voices within. And we need to own that we're half of the problem. And I just thought that was refreshing.
I'm there with that, and I'm there with all that uplifting rhetoric at the end of Obama's speech. I just think we've heard this for so long. It's 2004. Obama gave his great speech at the convention. We were all weeping about this country that's coming together. No, black America, white America, red or blue America, just the United States of America, and our politics is too poisonous. It's all true, and it's all going to continue, and I don't know. I'm tired of that.
You don't like to sit there and figure out which cabinet member's not in the attendance?
Yeah, and watch the generals. I love watching the cutaways to the generals and the Supreme Court justices because they must have rocks in their pants. They are never happy.
Justice Alito hasn't been there since he was scolded. Right?
Last year when Ruth Bader Ginsburg fell asleep?
Eric Zorn and Steve Bertrand. Boy, we just whipped ourselves into a froth there, didn't we? Recording that yesterday, the full conversation. By the way, that was the tail end of it. Actually, we started out talking about the latest police shooting video, about the battle for the state's attorney's office. Then we went to there, and then we always close with recommendations, something we're reading, watching, or listening to that we think you might enjoy. That's called Mincing Rascals. You can subscribe to it on iTunes. That's our weekly podcast. We post it at WGNplus.com and on my Facebook page where I'm King John. By the way, you heard something just now that you might want to react to. You agree or disagree, or there's another point about the debate or the State of the Union. Here's a chance to jump on the phone. 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Sean Penn's article in Rolling Stone was fascinating for all the wrong reasons. We're going to share some details from that, talk to an expert in journalism on that. That'll be after the 2 o'clock edition of WGN Radio News. This is John Williams. I just began the show today telling you that I was a little down this week because I didn't win the Powerball. I know that's way too much to give to the Powerball since you probably won't win on any given drawing, but since I'd lived with the notion, not just this past week, but the week before and all the previous weeks with the subsequent rollovers, there was sort of this mounting expectation or hope that I would win. Somebody has to win. Somebody in Tennessee would normally wake up and go, wow, a guy in Chicago won. Why couldn't a guy in Chicago or Minneapolis win? And the person in Tennessee go, well, it wasn't my turn. So that's sort of how you enjoy your $2 investment, because for $2, you can convince yourself that there's some hope that you could be a billionaire. And so I enjoy it, even though I was a little, as I said, down. Then there was this story by Alexia Alejalde Ruiz in the Chicago Tribune. And Rob, it details two instances where it went bad for winners. Pita Pan Bakery in Chicago Heights, group of 12 workers who claimed the winning ticket in a $118 million Illinois Mega Millions drawing in 2012, were sued by 5 of their co-workers who argued that they should share in the winnings because they regularly contribute to the rolling pot of lottery money, but they didn't that one time. And then they won, and they go, well, we're in, right? And they go, no, you weren't in this week. And they go, well, come on. And so they sued them. They settled for an undisclosed amount. And the next year, 2013, in Indiana, 7 employees at Lou's Creative Styles Hair Salon sued a co-worker who claimed that the winning numbers for the $9.5 million prize belonged to her personal ticket, not the group office pool tickets that she was also buying. That is bad form. I think if and the point from one expert in the article was you need to have rules. You need to have them written down. It's not a legal document. It can be handwritten, but then everybody sign when you put in your $2. And you need to determine, can the person buying the group's tickets also buy tickets for themselves on the side? And I'm a big what's the opposite of advocate of that? I do not subscribe to that. Rob, I don't want you buying tickets for yourself. You're either in with us or you're not in with us, but you can't be cutting side bets.
Well, that was the case around here, because I remember way back when the Mega Millions would get past $100 million, and it was always Judy Pilak who would go around the newsroom passing around an envelope saying, we're buying tickets, give me $2. And the expectations were, if you put in your $2, you would get a share of the winnings, whatever they were. We never won, but there were ground rules immediately, so everyone knew what they were getting. You had to write down your name too, so no one could say, "Hey, I put my money in. Give me dough."
But what if Judy? So you guys say collected $50, and she went out and bought tickets. What if then she took another $2 out of her purse and bought $2 for herself personally, and won with that, which is what happened in Indiana. And I'm thinking, because everybody goes, yeah, right. What you did was you traded out a losing ticket for a winning ticket and pretended that was yours. That's very problematic. And here, I don't know what the solution should be to this, but let me describe for you the dilemma we have. Our pool rolled over. We won $14. So we now have 14 collective dollars that they said, we're going to put back in when it gets to $200 million. That's when we start buying again, $200 million. But people can opt in or opt out. So the next time we do it, maybe you buy two tickets. Maybe you put in $2 for the next time, Rob, but you weren't part of that previous $14 rollover. Or maybe the opposite is the case. You were part of the $14 rollover. Say that. You were part of the $14 rollover, but you didn't buy tickets the next time. And the next time it hits, should everybody who was part of that $14 rollover be included in the new group of tickets that won, even if they didn't pay in the second time? I hope that makes sense to you. But that's sort of the complication we have where I work right now. And I said, listen, I don't want to be the guy that's saying, hey, we got a problem here, but I think we should get in front of that so that we don't have a case like they did in Chicago Heights or Indiana. And I don't know the solution. It'd be a good problem to have, you might say.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind trying to figure out who in this group of people gets to split up $1.5 billion.
Right, yeah, even $9 million. That's a good problem to have, I suppose. The other thing that I run into at work, and this has happened for years, I got into trouble at WGN when I would do this, would be everybody puts in $2, but I would put in $4 or $6, and I would say, well, that way we increase our chances of winning because we're buying more tickets. They think I'm actually trying to hog more shares of the winnings because I would be due more a higher percentage of the winnings. But I also think our chances of winning are better if we have more tickets. It's 1:58. Rob's going to do the news next. This is WGN. Thank you, Rob. At 2:09, John Williams on WGN until 3 o'clock. Then the boys from The Beat talk sports with you. You can follow me on Facebook. Like me there. I'm King John on Facebook. That's where you will find our Mincing Rascals podcast. I read a couple of times this week that Sean Penn article in Rolling Stone, El Chapo Speaks. I wanted to see what it was about, and then after I read it the first time, I thought, did I miss something? What's all the hullabaloo about? Why did CNN call this a bombshell interview? In part in his article, early on, Sean Penn writes, I take no pride in keeping secrets that may be perceived as protecting criminals. He notes that this will be the first interview El Chapo has ever granted outside an interrogation room. So it's a real score for him and that way Rolling Stone. He said he took some comfort in a unique aspect of El Chapo's reputation among the heads of drug cartels in Mexico. Unlike many of his counterparts who engage in gratuitous kidnapping and murder, Chapo is a businessman first and only resorts to violence when he deems it advantageous. He says things like this, are we as Americans, as the American public, not indeed complicit in what we demonize? We are the consumers, and as such, we are complicit via the drug trade in every murder in every corruption of an institution's ability. He says it's a question of relative morality when you say El Chapo and the Mexican drug cartels are wrong and bad, but aren't we too? He says there's little dispute that the drug war has failed. As many as 27,000 drug-related homicides take place in Mexico in a single year. And then he goes on to describe how he actually got the interview, which is a fascinating story. And in short, there's this Mexican film and television star named Kate Del Castillo, who in January of 2012 tweeted out to El Chapo, "Mr. Chapo, wouldn't it be cool that you started trafficking with love, with cures for diseases, with food for the homeless?" She wrote, "You know how to do it. Life is a business, and the only thing that changes is the merchandise. Don't you agree?" Chapo's a little smitten, and he sent flowers to her that she never got. But when he finally got out of jail the first time, everybody started talking about making his life story. "Let's do a movie." And there were considerable conversations about how much he could participate in that and with whom. Eventually, it became a good idea to at least write a good magazine article. And Sean Penn said, "Well, I will do that." He had a mutual friend with the actress. And so that begins the story then of him meeting El Chapo in the mountainous jungle of Mexico and actually having a face-to-face conversation with him. It was an interesting story up to that point. My big disappointment in the article is that the interview is not. I mean, the article runs, say, 14 pages. The interview is the last three, because when Sean Penn finally gets out there, it's been a long, grueling day, and then they talk into the night, but that's more kind of getting to know you, having some food, having some tequila, just feeling each other out. And then El Chapo says to him, "I will give you the interview you want in 8 days. Will you come back in 8 days? Sean Penn says yes. But when Sean Penn returned 8 days later, Chapo is now on the run, and they never got the interview. So then they agreed to email back and forth, or virtually Penn send questions, Chapo sit in front of a camera and then read his responses, which are not productive. The New Yorker has called the whole thing a mutually admiring jungle bro session. That needs to be read twice. A mutually admiring jungle bro session. A professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota is a friend of mine. She works at an organization called the Scylla Center, and her name is Jane Kirtley, and she joins us now. Jane, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm very well, thanks.
What do you want to say?
I'm so disgusted by this entire enterprise. I don't quite know where to begin. I mean, you've encapsulated what transpired, and I think most journalists who do journalism for a living would not really regard this as an interview, as you said, because he was basically eliciting responses to a series of email questions. There was no real back and forth. And significantly, Guzman and company had demanded basically a chance to review the manuscript before it was published by Rolling Stone.
I should mention that, right? They demanded that, and Rolling Stone complied. They sent El Chapo the transcript. He didn't demand any changes, but
right.
He had final approval.
He did. He had final approval. And the fact that he didn't ask for any changes to me is really immaterial. I mean, I've heard people say things like, well, don't magazines do fact-checking? And yes, of course, good ones do. But the difference between fact-checking and prior review by the source are two very, very different things from a journalistic ethics perspective. So I found that very troubling.
And that's your field. I mean, so you're a professor of media ethics and law, so I can see how this really cuts you. But there's no harm to me, right? I mean, is anybody in Mexico or the United States damaged by a badly written article?
Well, I think the Mexican journalists who face death literally every day when they're out trying to cover things like the drug cartels are harmed by this, if only because it will now reinforce what I think is their perception that many journalists are essentially working for the authorities. And, you know, Penn's involvement in this, whatever it may ultimately prove to be, and I'm not sure we've heard the end of the story yet about how Mexican law enforcement actually ended up apprehending El Chapo, this is just, as I said, reinforcing the notion that you can't trust a journalist because they're really an undercover cop. If Penn wants to be an undercover cop, I guess that's his business, but I don't like him doing it under the guise of journalism. So that's the first thing that really bothers me about this. The fact that Mexican journalists do face such great threats already, and this to me would just simply reinforce it and also trivialize what it is that they do. They could not have gotten an interview like this, at least not without great personal risk. So that's very problematic to me. The second issue may seem a little esoteric, but it is nevertheless something that I worry about, which is we're reopening this can of worms about who's a journalist, what constitutes journalism. And I take a very expansive view of that. I mean, I'm prepared to say that anybody that's gathering information to disseminate to the public is doing journalism. But if and when Sean Penn becomes the object of subpoenas, for example, to testify before a grand jury, assuming El Chapo is extradited to the United States, will he be able to claim any kind of journalist privilege? And if he tries to, will he end up making bad law along the way? So there could be harm not just to journalists, but frankly to the public's right to know if this plays out the way I am concerned that it might. I don't think that Sean Penn probably gave a lot of thought to the ramifications of that when he embarked on this little adventure.
Well, I wonder, too, since El Chapo has been discovered, and their attorney general in Mexico said that the interview played a part in El Chapo's capture, I wonder if Penn needs to worry about his safety now.
Well, I have no doubt that he is at risk. Presumably, he has better protection than a typical Mexican journalist would have. But if I were in his place, I would have some concerns. I don't know what will happen. I don't know what his security infrastructure is like. But it does seem to me that he's been identified now as an important linchpin in this whole apprehension of El Chapo.
But let me ask you about this. You mentioned, you know, is he a journalist or not? And that's something that sort of bristled the hairs on his neck as well. I'm going to play for you a soundbite. This is from the Charlie Rose interview that we'll all be able to watch, I guess, tomorrow, but excerpts have been released. And so here he is, Sean Penn, taking on the notion of what is or is not a journalist.
When you get the story that every journalist in the world wanted, there's a lot of green-eyed monsters who are going to come give you a kiss.
Those are jealous journalists you're suggesting?
Yes. Of course, I know that there are people who don't like me out of the gate.
You're not without controversy.
Not without controversy. Fair enough. At the same time, you know, when journalists who want to say that I'm not a journalist, well, I want to see the license that says that they're a journalist.
So what about that journalist, Jane Curtley?
Well, I mean, he certainly has a point that at least in the United States, we don't license journalists, and we don't want to do that under the First Amendment. But to me, and this is an issue that actually has come up in the law, a lot that goes into the analysis here, at least from a legal perspective, is what your ultimate goal is. Is it to inform the public, or do you have some broader agenda in mind? Are you acting as an advocate? Are you essentially acting as a public relations arm for somebody? Or are you acting independently, as a society professional journalist code of ethics would say, with your highest loyalty being to the public, not to anybody else? Whatever else did or didn't happen here, we've learned in the Charlie Rose interview that you mentioned that Sean Penn is now saying he had this broader goal in terms of trying to raise public consciousness about complicity, which you described in your opening comments. And, again, we like journalists. We like to think of journalists as trying to inform the public to lead to the better good of the general public. But this sounds to me like a guy who's got an agenda, who's advocating a position, and that's not, at least typically in the United States, what we think of journalists as doing.
You're describing Sean Penn now, a guy with an agenda. But
that's
a legitimate point. I mean, I don't mind anybody raising the notion that we look at what's happening south of the border and say those are bad, evil men while we're buying cocaine or marijuana or whatever our drug of choice is. We are part of that equation, right, Jane?
I would agree with that. I don't think that's a particularly profound observation.
No, that's not new.
But it's probably helpful for him to remind us collectively.
Fine,
of that.
But I think but a good question then is, all right, but where's the balance in this? And I have to tell you, on whole, when you read the Rolling Stone piece, El Chapo Speaks, I can't help but come away with the conclusion that Sean Penn was played here.
I think that's right.
It is such
a
rosy
to it. There is a almost hidden admiration to it. I mean, it reminds you of the glorification of a variety of thugs and criminals, you know, going back to probably at least the 1920s with Prohibition and everything else. You know, it appeals to the popular imagination if you just present these guys as Robin Hood or whatever. But the fact is, he's responsible for the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of people, and directly, and then as well indirectly in terms of the whole craziness of the drug trade in general.
Well, then, Sean Penn to that. Says you're missing the point, and I'll pick it up here in a minute. We'll hear from Sean Penn and Jane Kirtley, the Silla Center professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. This is WGN.
Yeah, I have a terrible regret.
What are the regrets?
I have a regret that the entire discussion about this article ignores its purpose, which was to try to contribute to this discussion about the policy in the war on drugs. Let's go to the big picture of what we all want. We all want this drug problem to stop. We all want the killings in Chicago to stop. We are the consumer. Whether you agree with Sean Penn or not, there is a complicity there. And if you are in the moral right or on the far left, just as many of your children are doing these drugs. Just as many. And how much time have they spent in the last week since this article came out talking about that?
Jane Kirtley's on a phone line with us. She's a professor of media ethics and law. Jane, what would your advice have been to Rolling Stone? Because Sean Penn had to leave, as did El Chapo himself, that first day they met. And 8 days later, the rendezvous was impossible. So now he's left with sending a batch of questions to an emissary of Chapo's who reads them to him, but not all of them. And then they just have to make do with whatever responses they get. And that's all they got. So what do you do? You know, here we are making fun of or are being agitated by how incomplete this process was. But what do you do if you're Rolling Stone?
Well, I think you hold your story unless you are convinced that you can never get anything else to make it a rounded story, which, of course, now that El Chapo's been apprehended, they probably won't be able to do much more. Everybody's been drawing a lot of parallels between this and the University of Virginia rape story. I think there are some similarities, and what I guess I would say is a rush to present a story and an unwillingness to basically recognize the weaknesses in it. You know, in the UVA story, it was relying basically on one source without bothering to corroborate. I think similar problem here, quite honestly, although that's not something anybody's really focused too much on. You're only talking to El Chapo, and you're not really putting it in a broader context. If their goal really was to educate the public and get a conversation going, I mean, Sean Penn says, everybody missed my point. Well, then you didn't do a very good job, did you, Mr. Penn, in presenting your piece? Now, how much of that can be blamed on the editor or lack thereof at Rolling Stone, I don't know that we would know. But, you know, and I guess my last comment is what I said earlier, which is that if the purpose of this is to do a journalism, a news story or news analysis, giving so much control to the subject is basically signing away your journalistic integrity.
Yeah.
And you might as well just say, we're doing PR for El Chapo. That's
well, and Penn doesn't have, you know, and Sean Penn is whatever he is. He describes himself as a journalist, and I think he makes an interesting point, particularly in this day where people have so much access to multimedia, what constitutes a journalist. So I get that, but I'm a little more worried about Rolling Stone's brand because they're legitimate, they're mainstream, they're interesting. So I'm not ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I sure think this hurts Rolling Stone is sort of an enterprising place for cutting journalism.
Well, for me, it certainly is because of all of the holes in the story and just the methodology of gathering it. And again, the prior review, which, again, some people would support, but which I think is very problematic, especially given the nature of this story and the subject of this story. I mean, you just giving prior review to a criminal like this is just, I mean, stunning.
Okay.
So I leave it at that.
I'm going to read you just a couple of lines as I let you go. This is from Sean Penn's article. He's describing the guards in the jungle when they do sit down that night. There's all of these men around there. And Sean Penn describes his henchmen this way: there are no long barrel weapons in sight. My impression of his crew is more in sync with what would imagine of students at a Mexico City university, clean cut, well-dressed and mannered, not a smoker in the bunch. I don't know how you know that, but he says our host is concerned that Kate, that's the actress that has come along to interpret, is the lone female among us, not face intimidating visions of force. I tell him that I understand that in mainstream narrative of Narcos, the undersung hypocrisy is in the complicity of buyers. Chapo smiles a warm smile. He says, I worry about coming across as a Pollyanna, Sean Penn does. But then he writes, I tried hard, folks. I really did. And reminded myself over and over of the incredible life loss, the devastation existing in all corners of the narco world. I don't want to be portrayed as a nun, El Chapo says. This simple man from a simple place, surrounded by the simple affections of his sons to the father, and his toward them does not initially strike me as the big bad wolf.
This is written by someone who I think is either ignorant, naive, or incredibly stupid. He saw what El Chapo and his henchmen wanted him to see. It is in no way, in my view, a reflection of the reality of this individual.
Here's the gonzo part, and then I'll let you go. This is the one that people are really scratching their heads about. Quote, Sean Penn writes, he walks us back toward the same bungalow where he had earlier escorted Kate. In a narrow, dark passage between ours and an adjacent bungalow, Chapo puts his arm over my shoulder and renews his request that I see him in 8 days. I'll be saying goodbye now, he says. At this moment, I expel a minor traveler's flatulence. Sorry. And with it, I experience the same chivalry that he'd offered when putting Kate to bed, as he pretends not to notice. We escape its subtle broom, and I join my colleagues inside the bungalow. What a guy, that El Chapo, huh?
What a swell, well-bred guy. I am just stunned. It's just, to me, disgusting just to have this kind of glorification of a drug lord like this. But, hey, you know, it probably will make a great movie treatment, and that's probably what Sean Penn has in mind.
Jane Kirtley is at the Silla Center at the University of Minnesota. If you got kids who want to study law or journalism, you could do a lot worse than having them sit in her classroom. It's nice to talk to you, Jane.
Thanks so much, John.
It's 2:30. We'll pause here. Rob Hart updates you on the news. Our Vibe Score segment's coming up on WGN. Rob, in just a minute, I'm going to do the Vibe Score segment. We always do that about this time when I'm on Saturdays, 2:38, as we get ready to crosstalk a little sports with the boys from the beat. We'll score the news as we do on our Vibe Score app. But before I get to that, did you see the video out of the three little girls that sang that sort of patriotic song before a Trump rally?
Yes, I did. I noted on Facebook a couple of weeks ago that my daughter, of all the stuff that I do on the radio, she enjoys the Cars for Kids jingle more than anything else. And he said, how about you teach her this song instead? And I watched it and went, yee.
It is kind of creepy. The girls are adorable. They look like they're somewhere between 8 and 13 years old. There's three of them. And they're all dressed up like they're going to a pageant. They've got red, white, and blue star-spangled skirts and glittery tops, and they're singing a patriotic song. The words have been changed. You'll hear it here in a second. But it's for Trump, so it's just kind of weird, isn't it, this song? It's, well, here's exactly what it sounds like. And the first words out of their mouths is the word cowardice. It's kind of upcut, so just so you know.
Cowardice. Are you serious? Apologies for freedom. I can't handle this. When freedom rings, answer the call. On your feet, stand up tall. Freedom's on our shoulders. USA! Enemies of freedom. Face the music. Come on, boys, take them down.
Got some hand jive motions and fancy dance steps over there, but it's Donald Trump. If we wake up and we're North Korea, I think there would be a lot of songs like that on the radio. It is positively You hate to say disturbing because the girls don't know. They're just singing a song. And everybody there at the rally is clapping their hands. And on the CBS Morning News this week, they played the video and then said, oh, that's adorable. Not a snarky observation amongst them. So maybe I shouldn't be snarky about it either. But there's something creepy about it. And I can't put my finger on it that well. But it sure did disturb me when I watched it. And I guess I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, the hard part about trying to be snarky about something like that, because then you just appear out of central casting. Here comes the elite media to make fun of a bunch of children and their heartfelt sentiment towards a guy they want to have be president.
Totally right.
On the other hand, you got to think that maybe parents, thanks to viral videos being a part of our lives for so long, maybe their parents are just so media savvy that they know by creating a video that is so unbelievably cheesy that it's going to live forever.
So their kids will forever be able to say, look, that's me. I got 27 million views. I helped Donald Trump become president or at least become part of the conversation. Yeah, I guess. But there's a lot of baggage that goes with that, right? I mean, years later, the kids could look at their mom and say, Mom, you did what? I feel that way about parents who post the video of the kids crying when their teams lose a big game or when they tell them that they ate all their Halloween candy. And then the kids act like these spoiled little tyrants. And when people post those videos, I wonder if they know how we feel about them, right? I mean, not everybody is loving these little girls. Maybe the parents don't care. And everybody in the crowd was loving them, so I'll cop to being the odd man out here. But I think there's some peril for your kids when you post a video like that, thinking everybody's going to praise it, because you're going to borrow a lot of animosity towards your kids, too.
Well, enlisting your children in the culture wars does not seem to end well. I remember the kid, what year was this? Maybe 2009 or 2010. He was 13 years old. And he delivered this absolutely blistering anti-Obama speech, and it was passed around social media. This 13-year-old gets it. And then they did a follow-up with him when he turned 18, and his beliefs did a complete 180. And he didn't like the fact that he was associated with that anymore. His whole attitude was, I was 13 and didn't know any better.
Well, we talked about that when we looked at the Ted Cruz online commercial. It goes about a minute and a half where he's reading bedtime stories to his adorable kids and his lovely wife. But all the bedtime stories are sort of parodies of famous books, but they're making Barack Obama's policies look bad. And so it's this funny send-up, right? But the girls are now part of, like you said, the cultural war. And I know they support daddy, but they really don't know, I think, what they're getting into. I wouldn't want to put my kids into that mix, that's for sure. All right, so anyway, enjoy it. It's online, and you can Google it. It's not on my Facebook page. It's 2:43. It's time for our Vibe Score segment. We'll start with this song. David Bowie's untimely passing made us think a little bit about, well, David Bowie's repertoire of music. We posted the video for Heroes, and we asked you to Vibe Score Heroes. Vibe Score is an app. You can get it for free, and we like to say you score the news. Actually, it was young Ross Cochran that sort of described it that way, and I thought that's it exactly, Ross. We're scoring the news on Vibe Score. We said, hey, what do you think of David Bowie's Heroes? It's getting a 90. My producer, Griffin, is an assistant with the Vibe Score app and scores each week, as well as authors some of the posts. In fact, you're the one that put that one up, aren't you, Griff?
Yeah.
Good song. 90. That's about as high as we get usually.
I gave it a 98.
I just was reminded of how out of the loop I was. I know Ground Control to Major Tom. I know Fame. I know some of his songs, but when I went back and listened to it, I thought, "Wow, what a cool guy!" You know?
Yeah, I've always admired him a lot, but I just never got into it. I would call myself a fan, except I don't know a ton of his music, to be honest. And when he died, I thought mostly of my friends who I know are huge, huge fans. But it was a real joy to go through and re-listen. Yeah. And that one, that's one of the hits, so that's kind of what I was thinking about. But it's such a great song. It's unbelievable.
Well, it was a bit of discovery for me, too. That's this whole week was, because I always felt David Bowie's really smart, really cool, way too cool for me. You know, not like, I don't mean that in a condescending way. I just mean I didn't get it, but I knew he was brilliant and artistic, and everybody else admired him. So David Bowie's Heroes scoring 90. On a scale of 1 to 100, you rate things. For instance, in the movies category, we put up a clip from The Big Short, and that's getting a better score than I think I gave it, Griff. It's getting an 84.
I don't know. You remember wrong. I think you gave it an 85.
Oh, you know what? You're right, I did. And upon further review, and you can do this, by the way, I may change my score on that.
How come?
Because I think those clever cutaways to people explaining The Big Short didn't work at all. They weren't that funny. They weren't that clever. And they didn't explain it. You still don't know what a short is watching that movie.
And I hated to burst your balloon on this one because I saw it. I've now seen it twice. And I wanted to go back and confirm that I didn't like it that much. I think it was very entertaining, and I think the performances were great.
Yeah.
Especially from Christian Bale and Ryan Gosling. I thought they were both phenomenal. But the movie overall, I couldn't get into. And I think it was the writing was kind of ham-fisted and bad. And those cutaways, you're right, because they cut away to famous people to help describe financial institutions or whatever. And the idea is, it's kind of a joke where it's like, oh, you'll pay attention to this person, right? But you can tell that they don't understand what they're saying.
They don't get it either.
And that really takes me out of it completely. Like, they deliver the lines fine, but you know in their heads that they're just reading lines, and then I can't understand that at all.
Well, besides, the
drove me crazy.
Look, The Big Short is that we all bought mortgages that we shouldn't have, and then these other people packaged them and sold them, and then we all went down the river. We all understand that basically, but I'd like to know a little more exactly how that went down. But the description I just gave you is all the movie gives you. So
I think I'm being hard on it. I think I had too high hopes. I gave it like a 57. I mean, that's not that bad. You're on the positive side there, and I think it was very entertaining. But overall, it left a bad taste in my mouth.
In the celebrities group, we posted Jennifer Lawrence at the Golden Globes dressing down a reporter who was a little too busy, first with his phone, and then he called them the Oscars. And she's beautiful and glittery and glamorous, and she's given it to him, and people think it's awesome. I think it was mean. I felt bad for the guy. You'll still be glittery and awesome. Do you really have to undress this poor kid?
Yeah.
I gave it a bad score.
The score is up at a 70, though.
I know. Because
I was really surprised to see that.
I know. News and current events. We asked you on the night that President Obama gave his last State of the Union address to vibe score the Obama presidency. 59. Probably a pretty fair match to the national sentiment. Barack Obama's presidency is hovering between 49 and 50-something in national polls. And on Vibe Score, it's getting a 59. Here's how you get a 59 on Vibe Score. Some people give it an 80, 85, 90. Other people give it a 22, a 7. In sports, Alabama wins the national championship. How happy are you about that? 22. Welcome to the Midwest.
When they poured the Gatorade on Nick Saban after the win, I thought, he is so boring and I hate him for it. I don't know why. I guess you shouldn't hate someone for being boring.
Fair,
like,
yeah.
It's not his fault. But
his job is to be a coach.
I know, but I thought you just won. And he just didn't seem... he's so stone-faced all the time and it drives me crazy. I think So I was low on that one, too.
By the way, we also asked you a couple weeks ago when Brian Urlacher got his hair famously cut to vibe Urlacher's hair. A lot of scores on this, and it's getting a 49. I like his hair. I think it's much... I was happy for him. I mean, he's not a linebacker anymore. Now he looks like a dad. So I was surprised that the score was as low for Urlacher's new look as it was. Most folks weren't in on it.
It's just jarring. It's not what you're used to.
It's true for sure. And finally, we asked you, Trump or Cruz or neither. And it was an interesting way we set up the scoring opportunity on that. And it came in almost straight up at neither.
folks weren't loving Trump. They weren't loving Cruz. Given the option of the two, they'd rather have neither,
yeah,
according 50, to the Biden
53,
score.
So right in the middle.
Yeah. Download the Vibe Score app at iTunes. It's free. It's one word, V-I-B-E-S-C-O-R-E. You can be part of the scoring, the news, and the dialogue. And we'll check in with this segment again next week. We'll see what the boys are talking about in the world of sports in a minute on WGN. We'll do the news with Rob Hart in just a couple of minutes. The boys from the beat are getting ready to talk to you, Connor McKnight and Mark Carman. Connor, what's going on this afternoon? How are you?
John, good to talk to you as always. We got we have a packed show, John. We really do. From 3 until 7:15, we'll walk you right up until Northwestern basketball. So I don't know if you've seen, and I don't know how you feel about it, John, but L.A. is getting football again. And yeah, in the midst of all this, you know, divisional playoff round and stuff like that, we're going to do quite a bit on the NFL moving to L.A. You have fond memories of the L.A. Rams?
I still call them the L.A. Rams sometimes. I still haven't got my head around the St. Louis Rams.
Yeah.
And the Arizona Cardinals. This is very confusing to me. So it's kind of resetting to me that franchise where it's supposed to be anyway.
John, I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but as we were talking about doing crosstalk with you today, Connor, and he's done this every single week that we've had the opportunity to do crosstalk
probably
with you.
Yeah.
He effusively says, "I love John Williams."
I do. I brighten up. It brightens my day.
And honestly, this is a true story. I have never seen him, as far as anyone in radio, throw that much love in anyone's direction close to what he throws at you. So just know that for whatever reason, and I love you too, but now I can't go to this level. This guy to my left, Connor McKnight, he loves you, John.
Boy, that's nice of you to say, Mark. And frankly, I'm not comfortable with the amount of affection he has for me.
I wouldn't. There are a lot of people who aren't. It's like John Williams. The man crushes I have on this show is like John Williams 1, and then Jeff Passan, and then Dean Lowry from Northwestern football.
Wow.
That's kind of our top three here on the show.
Wow. I forgot about Passan. Passan's a big one.
And Dean Lowry, yeah, those three guys. Like if we could all hang out, maybe get a four top at Chicago Cut or something. You know, I'll get the steaks and we'll see what happens.
I do run into that sometimes where there's a couple of athletes who I have this sort of, way too much love and affection for, mm-hmm. for no other reason other than I, you know, watch them on TV or, you know, if you like my show, I appreciate that. But there was a guy who played basketball at Butler University and he was sitting in the stands at my son's baseball game and I wanted to go up and talk to him, but I didn't know what to say.
Right.
I didn't know what to say. Just come up and I guess I could come up and say, "Hey, I enjoy watching you play basketball. I don't know anything else about you," but that seemed odd.
Isn't that such a weird feeling to have? I mean, with someone that you've never met, but you know them. And, you know, sometimes like you have that when you work in radio, like somebody will come up and be like, "Oh, I really like the show." And you walk away from that conversation thinking they know me more than they could possibly. You know, it's just this weird kind of, you know, juxtaposition of knowing someone, but really only knowing them from like 3 until 7 in the afternoon on a Saturday. You know, how much can you really know somebody there?
Well, so who's your walk-up guy, Mark? Like if you could walk up to somebody and just, it'd make your day to shake that athlete's hand.
Well, it always was Michael Jordan. As I've matured, though, greatly, it's become Michael Jordan. I'm going to stick with 23 on that one if I could just get a little moment of hang. But
well, you probably have, haven't you, in your comings and goings?
I have back in the day. Used to be in the herd and, you know, be one of the 500 guys that were trying to ask a question and my heart would be pounding the whole deal. That happened when I was – and I probably would be the same thing today whenever he kind of reappears because you never really see the guy. But, I mean, I had other – like B.J. Armstrong was a huge crush for me for whatever reason because he looked young and I thought he was just this adorable, cute Bulls guard that I could just be buddies with, which
and
never
you were
really
taller
happened.
Than him, so that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Yep, definitely taller. Turns out B.J.'s not really all that fun and lovable. He's kind of a cantankerous, onerous jerk a little bit.
But I actually did end up playing some hoop with BJ back in the day, which is kind of an amazing little.
Didn't know that.
Yes, he threw one pass out to me, and as I shot the jump shot, we were up like 7-3 in the game. As the ball was in the air, he's like 8, which is probably the greatest moment of my life. Now that I think about it,
He called it.
He knew that my shot was going down.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Can you imagine the moment? That was a big time moment.
Well, all right, boys. I'm going to put my goosebumps back and just have a terrific show again.
You got it. Will do, John. Thanks so much. Always good talking to you.